A graduate of Harvard College and Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons, Dr. Kelly Fradin is a pediatrician and a mother of two from New York City. Her career has focused on children with chronic medical conditions and school health. As an advocate for children, she wrote Parenting in a Pandemic, which provided calm, realistic, and evidence-based advice to families during this stressful time. Up next for Kelly is Advanced Parenting, expected in April of 2023. So let's welcome Kelly to the show to talk about how we can all stay calm as parents in this new normal. Dr. Kelly, thank you so much for joining me today. I am so excited to have your expertise and just get to know you better. I've been following along for a while since my friends at Canopy introduced me to you. And you're such a resource for parents out there with young kids, especially during COVID times and flu season. So thank you for just putting so much education out there for your community.
Thanks so much. It's nice to meet another Kelly devoted to wellness out there in the world, trying to share good information with people. I'm happy to connect.
Yeah. So what I noticed was that when I was going down the Dr. Kelly rabbit hole was that you were diagnosed with a rare childhood disease. Can you explain what happened and what led you to become a pediatrician?
Yes. So when I was three, I had fallen out of my bed one night and I had abdominal pain, and my parents brought me to the local hospital, which was kind of in the middle of nowhere, North Carolina. And they were, everybody there thought that they had abused me. So they snuck me out of the hospital and went to a big academic center where I was eventually diagnosed with cancer. And I had Wilms tumor and got chemo and radiation and surgery and all of that. And luckily, as a little child, I hardly remember it. And I enjoyed playing and going to preschool during it. But I do think it was really hard on my parents. And even once I was a grown up, when the pandemic began, my parents were like, remember, you had cancer. You have a different kind of immune system. They're still in caretaker roles, even though I'm like a very healthy mother of two myself. So I guess, that experience, it introduced the concept of medicine extending outside of the clinic or the hospital and really like touching your family life. And it helped me see, what it means for a family to have to advocate against and with the healthcare system to kind of make it work, and how important all of the things that parents do for their children outside of, what we think of as traditional medicine, the sleeping, the nutrition, the school, parents really do so much to promote their children's well-being. So I knew I was going to go into medicine because it was just a good fit for my interests, but I think it made me a better, more empathetic doctor to have had that background, because I just understood it from the patient side as well and the family side as well.
Yeah, that must have been horrific and scary for your parents to go through. I know as a parent, that's a fear of mine. I mean, especially if you're on social media, if you scroll one post about a child fighting cancer, you're served up hundreds of stories of it, and it seems like it's happening all the time. In your experience, how often are you diagnosing or referring out a patient that you think might be dealing with that?
Thankfully, childhood cancer is a really rare diagnosis. I don't know the exact numbers, but for the cancer I had, there are maybe 100 cases nationally, and there's, more than 50 million children a year born. So obviously, like, cancer is pretty rare. But the other side of it that I've learned as a practicing pediatrician is, it doesn't always take like a major medical issue to disrupt your family life. I can't tell you how many families I've met with food allergies or asthma or even, bad eczema, more quote unquote minor health issues that take a lot of energy to manage and that take a lot of thought and cause a lot of fear and disruption in the family life. So I think, even though obviously cancer may be the most worrisome kind of category that parents think about, there are a lot of children out there with their own issues that are just as worrisome and troublesome for families.
Yeah, I think as a parent, that rings so true for me, because Sebastian had was taken to the NICU, Children's Hospital, Los Angeles at his birth. And then we dealt with almost 5 months of really severe eczema, like pussy face, skin, all of his ankles, the backs of his knees. And it definitely kept me up at night, especially in my career and in my job, trying to pinpoint what's the cause of this. So as a pediatrician, how are you helping parents navigate these sometimes all-consuming issues?
So I think one big piece of it is that I view my role as a pediatrician to sort of educate and empower families. So I think it's sort of an old school mindset to think of the doctor as like writing down the plan and telling you what to do. And I think the more modern way to think about it is that the doctor is your partner in like listening to your concerns and addressing your needs and like helping you decide what's best for your family. And I think that extends to social media too. There's so much content out there that's like, do this, not that. It has to be this way. And often I try to remind parents that they are the best people to decide what works for their family. And I think it's important to kind of, especially first time or new parents, to give them the confidence that their judgment matters. You know, they are with their child often like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they know their child's needs and their family needs best. And it's good for them to feel comfortable speaking up about what they feel comfortable with and what they don't, because it just wastes everybody's time if the doctor sets you up on some plan that is discordant with your values or your preferences. It won't help you get better faster. Nobody wants to do that. So
definitely. Well, outside of, say, traditional medicine, you mentioned sleep, nutrition, school, and then dealing with things like food allergies or eczema. When a patient first comes to you, maybe it's a new parent, first time parent, how do you help them navigate and what advice do you give them for those buckets?
It's a great question. So I think it's important that you understand the kind of like what the family life is when you're helping a family, because sometimes the person who brings the child to the appointment is not always like the primary caregiver who's seeing the child every day. And so you have to take all the information you're given in context. And unfortunately that takes time. And sometimes these well child visits are kind of short and rushed, but it's helpful when doctors are able to really like get to know your family structure and what's important to you. And certainly when a problem comes up, like say a child's having a behavior issue, you certainly, before you start making a diagnosis or prescribing a treatment or therapy plan, you have to really understand what their life is like, you know, how they're sleeping, how they're eating, you know, what the discipline strategies the family's already tried have been. But, you know, and it's hard to do all that really well in a short period of time. But I think that's the challenge. That's the challenge for most doctors, is to really understand what you're dealing with so that they can make the best recommendations for the family.
Yeah. You mentioned short well appointments are rushed. I think that's an experience that we all have. It speaks to a bigger problem, I think, in reimbursement and the number of patients that you guys, the patient load that you're expected to handle. What advice do you have for doctors and parents listening when it comes to getting the most out of those short appointments?
Yes, that's a great question. I think it's always helpful when a parent has thought about what their goals are for the visit. It's always great when they come in with like their list of questions or their priorities so that we can make sure those are addressed. I can't tell you how many times parents sort of wait to the end of the visit, right as the doctor's getting ready to leave the room, to be like, oh wait, the real reason I'm here is this. And then it's hard for us to kind of extend. I think the other piece of it is, you know, a well child visit is designed to cover all this preventive healthcare. And even if it's a minor health concern, like say you happen to have a cold the day of your well child visit, if you try to handle the cold and the well child visit, you're going to shortchange yourself in terms of the amount of energy that you and attention that you get on your preventive health care. So a lot of times It would be more convenient for the family. It would spare you a copay if we could just like manage, you know, renewing your chronic care medications and giving you advice about learning problems at school, for example, all within a well-child visit, but it's kind of unrealistic. Sometimes we have to do dedicated follow-up visit if there's a real problem to discuss so that we can give it the attention it deserves. Otherwise, sometimes the quality of the advice is less.
Definitely. When you're looking at these milestone well-check visits, like right when you get home from the hospital, and like I can think of like your 6 month or your 9 month or your year, depending on, I guess, your pediatrician and how often they're asking you to come in, what are some, for each one of these big milestones for young babies into toddlers, what are you looking for as a pediatrician that child may be doing, and what should parents expect?
Right. So at the early visits, say, you know, up to 2 months, some people have a newborn visit and a 2 week or month visit, and then the 2 month visit, that really, those visits for me are half about the new parents. You know, how are they coping? How's their mental health? Is the baby gaining weight? How's the feeding going? Those are really the priorities of those visits, more so than any developmental check-ins. And then the four month to year visits are really big for development. There's a lot of changes going on, and that impacts, you know, the feeding and the safety concerns around the house. When kids start rolling or pulling up, we have to have conversations about how to keep them safe and stairs and things like that. So that's what's happening in that period. And then after one, it's interesting. I think that the ranges of development get bigger and bigger. So whereas maybe sitting without support might be like a 3 month window for when it might happen, you'll see that like walking is more of like a 4 to 6 month window of normal. You know, there's just a bigger range for when these things happen. And then certainly in the preschool age group, I have 2-year-olds who are putting two words together and 2-year-olds who are telling me a 3-paragraph story, you know? And I think it can be hard as a parent, particularly in pandemic times when you're not around as many kids, or maybe you don't see as many age matched people, to understand that there is that big range of normal. So at that stage, I think it's less about accomplishing milestones or like hitting targets, and more about like, where's your child now and where are they going? And so those are fun visits to do, because I think that when your child is talking back more to the parents tend to have more confidence by that stage too, that like the kid's doing okay.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, speaking of COVID and parenting in a pandemic, in the midst of COVID, you wrote a book, Parenting in the Pandemic. Can you share why you decided to write it and what were some of the takeaways?
Sure. So I was working for a New York City Department of Health before the pandemic. I had a backpack and I was going school to school, doing this safety program in the South Bronx for kids with asthma and diabetes. Which was wonderful, very rewarding work to kind of catch children who were falling through the cracks. But when the pandemic hit and the school shut down, it was just like all of a sudden that job was done. They said, you know, you could keep coming in and be a COVID swabber. And I was sort of like, I have to Zoom school my children. And I had a 2 and a 7-year-old at the time. So that wasn't happening. So I ended up quitting my job, and I was obsessing about the news. I mean, in New York, early in the pandemic, it was a very stressful time. It really you can't overstate how scared people were and how hard hit the hospitals and the communities were at that time. You know, especially if you lived in an apartment building, you share a ventilation with other units, and people were worried that they weren't even safe in their own homes. You know, it's just really like a terrible time. And I was pacing around my apartment, you know, and I felt like I had the knowledge and the research, and there was this network of doctors who were talking about what they were seeing, like to really like help parents understand what was going on and put it into context. And, you know, I found that a lot of parents, because we have this instinct as parents to protect our kids, maybe our concern for our children was over where it needed to be. Because the truth is that COVID is worse for adults. And so, you know, we had even pretty early on awareness that a 40-year-old was at like 100 times higher risk of having a problem from COVID than a 4-year-old. And so for most parents, it was like, stop worrying so much about your child. Like, obviously keep them safe and do what you need to do to keep them safe, but please worry more about you because, kids need their parents and their grandparents to be safe, to be protected and loved and happy. So that was kind of the motivating factor to write the book. I remember talking to my husband about it and he being like, somebody should do this. And he was like, you should do this. I was like, okay. Cause I had a psychology background. So I guess I had more than the average insight into how people cope with extreme stress and the consequences of toxic stress. And that aspect of it, I talk a lot about in the book, like how do we balance and how do we cope with what we're coping with and the degree of it. Cause we can anticipate even where we are now, which is in a much better place with vaccines and everything, that it's going to take us a long time to recover from what has been such a substantial event. So to sort of prioritize the long view was part of the goal of writing the book. And I had a great experience with it. You know, I think it reached a lot of families and I ended up speaking with a lot of companies and schools to kind of provide guidance about how to handle the pandemic with children. So I'm glad I did it. But it was pretty dramatic at the time. I wrote the whole thing in like a month and I had never written a book before or anything. So my pandemic hobby.
You went into it and you were probably feeling all of the stress yourself. You were in the eye of the storm with your children and as a physician and we're thankful for it. So what are some of the takeaways that you have for parents? Cause I do feel like I can only imagine what it was like in New York, because even just feeling in the pressure cooker of LA, I was like, I need more space. I can't be in this apartment. I need to be by nature. I need fresh air. We all felt really scared. And now it feels like we went from a stressful event into chronic stress. So yes. What were your tips for managing sort of the eye of the storm, and how are we supposed to get back to normal life? And what is normal life right now?
That's a great question. So I guess when we were really in the thick of it, one thing I wanted to help parents figure out is how to consume sort of like the fire hose of information and not get sort of panicked over every new headline, because the news is there to sell news, not really like, and they do a wonderful job of keeping the public informed, but sometimes the sensationalism can make you feel like every day is completely different, when in fact that, like, even by 3 or 4 months in, we had a pretty good sense of what we were dealing with. Have we learned more? Of course, but it's not like a whole new virus every time a new strain comes out. So to sort of learn how to process the news, learn how to talk to your family about it. I think a lot of parents struggled with finding the balance of, your child's world has changed too, and what's the developmental capacity of like a 3 or 4-year-old to understand what's going on, and how do we ask them to do things like mask or distance without making them feel unsafe, and how do we keep our grandparents safe, and so sort of dealing with sort of the nitty gritty of what parents were facing, like the day-to-day decisions, and then the decision fatigue, and going to the grocery store was suddenly like a life or death decision, which was very stressful. So how could we make fewer decisions in a week rather than making like 100 decisions a day, develop like some protocols? My family for a long time was just like, outside is fine and inside we have to think about. And I think the other thing I talk about a little bit in the book is there's this comparison trap that we all fall into of like, oh, this family is making different decisions than what we've made. Does that mean that I'm wrong? And as parents, we always want to do what's safest, because safety is so important. But like, there's also the other side of the coin of like, if we keep our family overly restricted, that might not be safe for our mental health. And every family is balancing their decisions based on things that are sometimes private. And so you don't always know who is on immunosuppression for inflammatory bowel disease and being super careful, or who's, you know, depressed and anxious and being more social and out there, because it really is important to their family. So I try to, like, you know, empower families to really, like, think about what matters most to them.
Really important topics.
Yeah.
Even just the beginning, sorry, I just cut you off. I didn't know you were going to keep going, but thinking about like a 3 or 4 year old masking up and having that conversation, like that, those are the conversations Chris and I were having. Sebastian was 18 months. I mean, he was very young. But you know, now he's 3. So what advice do you have for parents whose kids are just going to school for the first time, and, or, you know, looking at last year being all pretty much virtual and kids are back in school with the progress we've made? What advice do you have for parents at what age talking to their kids about what COVID is?
It's a great question. I think one of the most important pieces of it is that we know that chronic stress has big tolls on the health, on the body and on the healthcare system. You know, that day-to-day, you know, feeling fear and tension, it makes your blood pressure go up. It makes your cortisol levels go up, which impacts your insulin sensitivity and your blood sugar levels. And it impairs your sleep and healing. You know, stress is really toxic in a lot of ways. So my goal in how we talk to our kids is to not make it so scary. Instead of saying things like, put your mask on, you're going to get sick, or put your mask on, you're going to get grandpa sick, you know, those things motivate really by fear, otherwise choose what's important to your family values. Like, put your mask on so we can be respectful of the rules, put your mask on so we can keep our neighbors safe. You know, it flips it around into like, we're doing something positive for our community rather than like, we're preventing catastrophe. So that's one piece of it. And then the other piece of it is that I think many parents, that the attitudes are contagious. So it's hard for many parents to put a mask on a preschooler. Like, we don't want to cover up their beautiful smiles. And we feel, even those of us who are pro-masking, like nobody is like, yes, let me put on a mask. Their cost to masking, their barriers to masking. And so I think there's a little bit of inside your family public relations about the masking, like, you know, that you have to kind of swallow some of your indecisiveness or your negative feelings about the mask when you're communicating with your child about it, and set the tone of like, this is what we do. And kids do adapt to it. But when it first started, I too was skeptical of 2-year-olds being able to mask, but I tell you, 2-year-olds are often better than adults at masking.
I think as long as there's a Paw Patrol on a mask or a really cool superhero or something, I've had success. Now, more than ever, it's really important that we're voting with our pocketbook. I think we can look at every decision we make as a way to support brands that are focused on our planet's health and sustainability. And in the last year and a half, I've really tried to clean out my closet. And that's when I found Vuori. So Vuori is an athleisure brand. And if you've been at school drop-off, I think 1 out of every 4 moms are wearing their performance joggers because they're really, really comfortable and they come in amazing colors. But the reason why I love Vuori so much is because they're committed to offsetting 100% of their carbon footprint, and they're focused on sustainable materials. So not only are they really high quality, beautiful, and super comfortable, but they're really focused on a healthy planet. So if you are looking for a way to gift your family members something that they're going to love, but also support brands that are focused on sustainability, Vuori should be a brand that's on your radar. And if you haven't given their clothing a chance, I recommend their performance jogger and their daily legging. And if you have a hubby, their men's core short is awesome. But I also want to support you to do that. So you're going to receive 20% off your first order and free shipping for orders over $75, and you get free returns. So all you need to do is go to Vuori.com/Kelly, and you can see all of the amazing options they have. That's Vuori.com/Kelly, and Vuori is spelled V-U-O-R-I .com/Kelly. And the deal you're getting is 20% off your first order and free shipping for orders over $75, and they have a free returns policy. So you can't lose by giving them a try and just feeling how soft and luxurious these sustainable clothing options are for your athleisure wear. Speaking of in the classroom and COVID concerns, how are you easing parents' minds when it comes to sending their kids back to school? And have you seen patients not want to go back to school in your community, in your practice? And what's your advice there?
So because I view school as such a huge resource for children, you know, academically, socially, for their play and their emotional well-being, their connectedness with their peers, who children learn so much from their peers. I have been a big advocate of keeping kids in school as much as possible. And I know every family makes decisions, you know, based on their personal risk tolerance. But I do think that we have to think long and hard about children's social needs in terms of their development. So I've very much encouraged people to continue to get children connected with other children and be in school, because I think we know how to do it safely. And even if you're not in a formal school environment, if you're going to accept activities like play dates with other friends or sports or art class or some kind of exposure, when you're piecing together a plan, you have to add it all up and consider what you're exposing your family to compared to school. Because the benefit of school is that it's a fixed cohort. You know, it's like the same families over and over and over again. So you can, especially if you're a family with multiple children, say you're homeschooling two children, but then you're going to let them each see two of their friends and play, do one activity. Like, very quickly, your exposure level from those three different things that both children are doing will add up to be equal to school. And school is like, you know, 8 to 8 hours a day. And it's just much more stimulating and exciting for children. So I encourage people always to think through the whole story of both sides.
Definitely. Well, I'm really excited that Sebastian's in school. He started preschool this year, and I've just, even from September, and it's now just close to the end of October, seeing his brain explode and just his language, and just also a really great chance for him to learn to be resilient and grow through adversity, like feeling scared of being dropped off, so then feeling really confident and running down the hallway like that. As much as it, you know, I want him to be hugging and holding on to me, it's really a beautiful thing to see your children grow in those ways. And I think it's, I love that sentiment. So I've seen it personally in my family, and just really excited for him to have new friends and consistency. Like, I think a schedule is really great for kids. So now that our kids are in school, you're the expert here. What are the best ways that we can increase their immunity so that they are set to fight viruses and flu season?
Right. So I'm a big advocate of the basics when it comes to this question. So, you know, children who don't get enough sleep are often getting sick more frequently, you know, getting in, like setting up your schedule and setting up your life to facilitate the good amount of sleep your child needs, you know, maybe like 9 to 12 hours, depending on the age of your child. Sleep is a big priority. Also, encouraging children to eat a balanced diet with fruits and vegetables. I think that the benefit of sort of eating the rainbow is robust when it comes to having a strong immune system. The other one that we talk about less traditionally, but I think there's more and more evidence for, is about humidifying the air. So we know that nose and your throat and your airways. They're like part of your defense system in terms of catching a virus. And hospitals have found that if they keep the humidity like between 45 and 50, there's less hospital acquired infections. And I think we know that these mucous membranes, like they work better when things are humid. So I've encouraged parents either to use humidifiers or to use, nasal saline sprays or neti pots. Like it depends on your climate. Obviously, if you're in somewhere humid, like Florida, it might not be as necessary, but if you're somewhere where it gets cold in the winter, the humidity drops, I think that can increase your risk of getting, colds and flus.
Definitely. I think, I obviously use and love the canopy. That's how we were introduced. Pretty cool new technology where you're not having the growth of mold in that humidifier. I had always steered clear of humidifiers because of that reason and didn't love that they ruined my furniture because they sent so much liquid up into the air or steam, if you will, vapor. So shameless plug there for those guys that are our friends, but
love that you can dishwasher friendly is a big selling point for my patients because scrubbing those things with a toothbrush is no fun. So whenever you add something to your plan, like a humidifier, you have to make sure that you're keeping it clean so that it doesn't do more harm than good. So it's always good to prioritize one that you can maintain.
Definitely. What about supplementation? There's been a lot of research on vitamin D. What are you recommending for your kit for parents and the children in your practice?
It's really interesting. I wish that we had better quality evidence about some of these things. I think vitamin D is probably the supplement that I recommend most often. And whenever I do blood work on a child, I always say like, let's just get a vitamin D level too, because it's so common to find children who are vitamin D deficient. And often you have to know your supplement because often some of the supplements are quite low, like 400 units of vitamin D doesn't always guarantee that you'll be in the sufficient range. So sometimes identifying the children who are really deficient can help you really get them up to the right level. But vitamin D seems essential for good immune function. And there's some evidence that zinc is another one, although the zinc deficiency is less common. It does seem that having a little extra zinc can promote your immune functioning.
That's great. When you draw, I love that you're evidence-based and looking at blood work with your patients. At what age do you start drawing blood and looking at numbers on children, and what are your favorite markers that you're looking for?
So it's hard because obviously young children, blood work is a real pain. I wish that we had a finger prick point of care vitamin D machine, because if I had access to that, I would probably do it earlier and more often. But as it is, to have to put the needle and get the blood is a big hassle that most people want to avoid. In my practice, the AAP recommends we check the cholesterol around age 10, the lipid profile, and so I'll add it on to those visits. Sometimes, depending on the family's preferences, we'll do blood work around age 4 or 5, just to check for things like anemia and vitamin D and in families. This is a little controversial. It's not something that's recommended generally, but in families who are higher risk for celiac, I sometimes they are interested in screening the children because, in Caucasians in particular, the incidence of celiac is probably between 1% and 3%, which is not insignificant. So if a child is having trouble growing or gaining weight, if they have, rashes or frequently upset stomach, sometimes I'll be quick to add that on. Not that I'm doing it with every single person, but we talk about it.
That's great. I would have found out that I was celiac before 25 years old at that rate.
There are so many people that have that happen. And I think that, so then the question is like, how many children would you want to test that don't have it to justify? And so in my mind, it's like, if I tested 10 children and one had it, would I be like, it was worth it? And I think probably. Yeah. Like, even, I think so. So
I would have appreciated it.
It'll be interesting to see now that we know more about celiac and sort of the long-term consequences to your health of getting on the diet sooner. I wouldn't be surprised at all if we implement some kind of formal screening in the future about that. So
it's important. Now, what happens if someone contracts COVID or gets the flu this season? They've, you know, done everything that they could to be safe. You know, they're doing what they need to do and they contract it, either COVID or the flu. And if there's different recommendations that you're making in regards to everyone's health for each, please let us know. But what's your advice for parents when it happens to their family?
So I know that a lot of parents, their children didn't get sick a lot during the pandemic because they were more isolated and everyone was being so careful. So by and large, I've seen that families feel a lot of stress during the first cold. Like we're all out of practice, you know, nobody's been sick in a while and it just feels worse, even though, you know, some of the colds are a little bit worse because the children haven't been sick in a while, but even that, I think part of it is just, we used to be used to getting sick all the time and we just haven't done it in a while. So don't panic would be my first advice. And pursue testing would be probably the second, because there's really no way to know. You'll see on social media, all these charts about like what's flu, what's a cold, what's COVID. And the truth is that nobody knows unless they do a test, especially in children who sometimes have few symptoms of COVID. This is the only way to know. And then, you know, in terms of what you do for a child who has COVID, assuming that they're not high risk for some reason, like heart disease or diabetes, so, you know, if they're truly high risk, they should talk to their doctor, especially over 12, because they are candidates for antibody treatment. But if it's a child who's otherwise healthy, it's going to be the same kind of guidance as with the flu, you know, supportive care, rest, fluids, Tylenol and Motrin as needed for discomfort and those sorts of things. And isolation, of course. I think right now, because of how scared people are about getting sick and transmitting, I think all of us are more hesitant to send a child out into the world with a sniffly nose than we were before. So I think it's appreciated by your community when you're erring on the side of caution and getting tested and staying home.
Definitely. Our family contracted COVID and we didn't have symptoms and we found out that my niece had it. And so we were in contact with her and we all got tested and we stayed home for 14 days, but it was very eerie just because our experience was so opposite. But I just knowing that, like, it's crazy that I do think that people are walking around with COVID and have no idea that they have it.
Right. Well, you know, the good news though, is that those people are probably less likely to transmit it too, right? Cause they're not breathing fast. They're not coughing. They don't have like the sniffly nose that, you know, they're not kind of spraying it out in the environment in such high levels. So there's that piece of it. But yeah, it's so hard too, because you can't predict who's going to have that kind of course versus not. Because my husband got COVID in February, actually, like February 2020, before the pandemic started. We didn't know it was COVID at the time until the blood test came out where you could check for antibodies. But he's a healthy guy, like in his mid-30s, and he was sick as a dog for like 10 days. Wow. And so I wouldn't have predicted that he would have gotten so sick. It just seems like luck of the draw.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm looking forward to having just more research around it and understanding more about the virus and whether there's like a genetic component and a nutrient component, like vitamin D or zinc or something like that, or a hereditary component. Like it's, you know, we know the comorbidities of heart disease and diabetes and things like that. But it's just, like you said, luck of the draw. It's really interesting to scary and interesting and all the things to follow. But I really appreciate all that you're putting out.
Yeah. I think the other factor that gets we forget about is the dose. So interesting when you look at like doctors who do intubations and take care of the face, that they have a much higher rate of contracting COVID. But there's something to be said for like, if you're barely exposed versus heavily exposed, that your sickness might be different, which is interesting. And Monica Gandhi, who's one of the people who has written a lot about the pandemic, had put something out there along the lines of like, maybe that's the best part of masks, is that they reduce the dose, that maybe they don't like totally always prevent sickness, but they reduce your exposure dose if you are exposed, which is really interesting thought.
Definitely. Well, you've done and shared a lot during this pandemic, and I know your whole community, including me, appreciates it. But it's exciting to know that you're moving on, and your next project is going to be called Advanced Parenting, your next book. So I'd love to learn more about what's coming next for you and what this book is going to be about.
Yes. So my career in pediatrics has focused sort of on children who have chronic medical conditions, children who face challenges like mental health issues, academic issues, or medical diagnoses. And so the idea behind the book is that families who are coping with these sorts of challenges have like a whole nother layer of things that they're considering when it comes to family dynamics and siblings and school and communicating with people in their neighborhoods and fostering friendships. And so, and coping with stress too, you know, parenting is exhausting, but being a parent and a caretaker is like a whole nother level of stress. So the idea behind Advanced Parenting is that I will sort of dive into those issues and sort of, you know, it's not a book like for somebody who has X condition. It's just to kind of unify that like everybody who's dealing with these kinds of challenges faces similar things, and hopefully build some community and support for those people so they don't feel like they're facing it alone.
So in your practice, working with families who maybe have children with chronic diseases or something, whether it's mental health or physical, what do you see is sort of the major hurdle for those parents, and what when a family is thriving versus one that might feel like they're flailing, what differences do you see in those families, and what advice do you have for families who have things like that?
Yes, I think one of the most people struggle at the beginning, I'll say, you know, that you know, getting that original plan in place and the original education and the correct diagnosis and the right team of people to support you, that is often a stressful time for everybody. There are ways that you can make that a little bit better. But I think what's most important is that you kind of focus on your long-term goals and make it a sustainable plan, because, you know, you have to confront things like, sometimes your child's condition is going to be the most important thing, and sometimes your family might be facing other priorities. And so how do you make sort of tough decisions about the well-being of your whole family, and what can you kind of outsource and what can you not, and what matters? So I think I dive into some of those issues about finding like balance and sustainability in your journey, because I think a lot of families can find it kind of overwhelming.
Yeah, I'm sure the hardest part is getting that diagnosis and really understanding what's going wrong here. And then once you understand it, education is super empowering to be able to take you the long road for whatever it is you have to do for your child.
Exactly.
I feel like that's what parenting is. It's a long road, but it's a beautiful road. And the children are such a gift. So what advice do you have for parents when it comes to being resilient through things like the pandemic or a diagnosis? And and what's your personal experience as a mom with that?
I would say that as a parent, often we're very hard on ourselves. Our expectations are, you know, through the roof, that we just want to be everything to our child. And I think it's really important, whether you're facing a challenge or not, to acknowledge that you're part of a community of people to support your child, that you know, during the pandemic, you couldn't be like the teacher, the PE coach, and the therapist for your child. Like, there's only so many roles you could fill at once, and that it's okay to ask for help. Not only is it okay, it may result in like just more resources for your family and your children and better support. So I think that's one of the most important things, is that we have to be kind to ourselves and honest with ourselves about what we can and can't do, so that we can kind of fill our whole family's needs. Like, it's so common for parents to put themselves kind of last, and it's because they love their children, and I'm so thankful for that. But truly, parents' needs matter for the well-being of their children. You know, when a mom is worn down, you know, she's more short-tempered, and she, you know, she's not going to be as happy, and that impacts the child too. So I think that's probably one of the biggest tips I would have, is to think about the parents' needs too.
That's such a good one and really relevant. Just thinking of my own career and on stressful days, like, I'd rather give Sebastian less time and be a little bit more calm and have handled something than let him feel that energy. And it's a hard thing to do, to take into practice as a parent. Such a good piece of advice for everyone. How are you creating those boundaries in your house? Because you obviously have a big career. You wrote one book in a pandemic, you're writing a second. What does day in the life of you and your family look like? And how do you divvy up the roles and try to put your own mask on, oxygen mask on first?
It's a great question. I have to say, I'm probably not the best person at this. So I was waiting to see if the book deal would come through when the opportunity to work in my current practice came in. And it's a special group. And I ended up signing up for this full-time job before I knew I was going to be writing the book. So now it's like I have two full-time jobs and two little kids. And so I try to balance it. But I think the great thing about what I'm doing is that I have a lot of control over my schedule. So for example, when I end up sometimes like blocking half a weekend day to go take care of one of my patients. And then when I do that, I'm often able to say like, look, I can block a little time on a weekday afternoon to pick my son up from school because, you know, cause like I can control my schedule. So that helps a lot for my sanity. And I grew up with a mom who worked, she worked outside the home, but from home. So, I got that, that sometimes the quality of the time together was more important to us than the quantity of time, for sure. So I try to remind myself of that. And it does take like a real conscious effort, because there's a lot going on social media and a lot of people emailing and texting me about work stuff. So sometimes I have to actually like physically put the phone like away and be like, I'm not going to listen to any dings or buzzes for an hour. I'm just going to like sit here with my kids. And sometimes it makes you feel this little itch of like, what am I missing? What was that? But then I try to like take some breaths and really like be present for some time with the kids. Family dinners and things like that.
It's true. You could always be working, especially if you work for yourself and you have projects like a book. There's always something to be doing, and add layer social media on top of that, layer email on top of that, and you're pulled in a million different directions. Putting your phone in a different room is just the only way that I can totally commit to that time. And it's funny because I'll want pictures of my kids doing whatever we're doing. So I always make my husband, I'm always like, Chris, come take a picture of us. Because I feel like I don't, you know, there's this also gut need to take a picture of my kids doing what they're doing. If they're playing in a tent or they built a cool Brio train track or they're being silly, like I don't want to forget it. And that's part of it too. So, but I'd rather be not distracted than have the photo, I think.
For sure. It's a balance. Cause then you take it out for one little photo and 20 minutes later, you're like, what happened?
Right. Exactly. Well, Dr. Kelly, I can't thank you enough for your time today and for supporting your community and mine to build the immunity in our children, to handle hard diagnoses, and to really know what the heck we're doing during COVID. So thank you for everything and for being here. I'd like to end this podcast with one question, and that is, what does body love mean to you and your family?
So body love, it's funny. I think that my children are growing up with lots more overt teaching about body love than I did, but to just sometimes express gratitude about your body. So, you know, obviously I mentioned I had cancer. Like my body has in some ways failed me. Like it has gotten sick. It has had surgeries, but then I'm really thankful for sometimes like that I have this strength to throw my kids up in the air and that you know, I have the stamina. So I guess finding gratitude for what your body can accomplish is what I try to teach my kids.
It is. It's an amazing vehicle to experience all the world has to offer. And that's a really beautiful way of putting it. So thank you for being here. Where can people follow along? Where can they find your books? When is Advanced Parenting coming out? Tell us everything.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. So my Instagram account is called Advice I Give My Friends, because that's kind of was the idea behind when I started it. It was like pediatrician advice, but the kind I would only give my friends. And I have a website, adviceigivemyfriends.com, where you can find the links to Parenting in a Pandemic and my newsletter. Advanced Parenting is supposed to come out in April of 2023, which seems like it's a long way away, but that means I have like 6 months to write it. So yeah. I'm going to get working on it. So it'll be ready for everyone to check out when it's time.
I love it. No, I know book deadlines. You finish the book in a year and 14 months later it comes out. Yeah. It's great. I'm so excited for it. And I will put links to everything in today's show notes. Thank you so much for being here. Everyone, go follow along at Advice I Give My Friends.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at bewellbykelly.com and follow me on Instagram at bewellbykelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.